I am honored to call the Property Tax Division to order. Thank you so much to authors and their testifiers for waiting. We had a bit of a technical difficulty. I'm delighted we didn't have to move rooms. So, and with that, we do have a quorum, and could I have a motion to approve the minutes of March 11th?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Vang moves the approval of the minutes of March 11th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. And with that, members, since we have such a crowded agenda and we have local government officials who've driven across the street, the state, and some of them across the street, they were in the Senate earlier today. But some of them have come a long distance. We're trying to take those first when we know of them. And that isn't you, Representative Hertaus, sorry. And your commute wasn't that long. But we are going to try and move through these quickly so that we can get through the full agenda tonight. So thank you for your patience in setting it up. And with that, Representative Lane, would you please come forward to present House File 1104? And Representative Vang moves House File 1104 to bring it before the committee for consideration for possible inclusion in the omnibus report, the division report. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, Representative Vang. Thank you for the motion. Appreciate that. I appreciate hearing my bill tonight, House File 1104. And this bill would appropriate $1 million annually on an ongoing basis for the Border City Enterprise and Development Zone program. The bill also includes some technical cleanup language that was included in last session's tax bill to clarify exactly which types of businesses qualify for dollars from this program. The new language would allow for food and beverage facilities not operating a franchise agreement that requires the businesses to be located in Minnesota and automobile sales and services to be able to utilize these dollars. The dollars would be allocated on a per capita basis to the following five cities: East Grand Forks, Moorhead, Dilworth, Breckenridge, and Ortonville. These cities face a unique circumstance of being located on the western border of Minnesota, immediately adjacent to the North Dakota cities of Grand Forks, Fargo, and Wahpeton, and the South Dakota city of Big Stone City. Although Minnesota's economy is healthy right now, and has been since the Great Recession, the differences in tax rates pose challenges for these five Minnesota cities' business climates. On top of this, North Dakota has been operating a renaissance zone since 1999 that allows for state-funded tax incentives for economic development. The Border City Enterprise and Development Zone program is an effective, proven tool that has been in place since the early 1980s. In my own community of Moorhead, we are seeing some economic development begin to take place. This began over the last couple of years with new developments happening in downtown Moorhead, and I credit much of this new development to an organization called Downtown Moorhead, Inc., which is a nonprofit started by Moorhead business leaders to work directly with developers in undertaking projects on the east side of the Red River, and also former Mayor Delray Williams for changing the conversation about what Moorhead has to offer in terms of economic development. Again, sticking with my home community, a lot of development is happening in the Fargo-Moorhead area, both in terms of residential and business development. The permanent Border City Zone program appropriation will help to ensure some of this development occurs in Moorhead by allowing the city to make long-term plans for new business development and existing business expansion. In the context of an annual state budget between $23 and $25 billion, a $1 million annual appropriation for economic development on the western edge of Minnesota is a fiscally sound way to utilize state resources that will leverage private sector growth for positive community development. And Madam Chair, division members, at this time I can either stand for questions, or we do have Lisa Bodie with the City of Moorhead to make some comments.
Thank you. Do any members have question on the underlying bill? Otherwise, we'll move to the testifiers. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record, Ms. Bodie.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Lisa Bodie. I'm the Governmental Affairs Director for the City of Moorhead. And I told your colleagues in the Senate that as I look out my office window, I see the largest city in North Dakota. And as I drive through that city, I get to the fastest growing city in North Dakota. We've prepared some materials for you that you should have in your handouts that include details of some of the statistics that really show what those disparities are that have that require the border cities for Morehead to be competitive. And as Representative Lean indicated, and you can see in this packet also, that we are growing as a community. But North Dakota is growing also, and they're growing faster. And so what we want to do with a sustainable appropriation is ensure that there are resources available to help us compete to attract business, because it is important for community vitality. As you look at our taxable sales, as you look at our estimated market value for commercial industrial property and our net tax capacity, we do have issues that we need to address on that North Dakota border. What we are trying to articulate is that this resource is a necessary resource for border cities, but it's also good for the state of Minnesota, in that any growth in Minnesota is good for our community and for the state as well. So, again, we will stand for questions. Shall you have any?
Thank you. Representative Lane, do you have other testifiers?
Madam Chair, committee members, I do not.
Okay. They're just listed as available for resources. Yes. Then. Thank you. Anyone in the committee who would like? Oh, Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two questions. One is, does this program still have a surplus in it as it did last year? And then wondering if it would be beneficial to the committee, it would to me, for Ms. Dalton to remind us how this program works. Or Mr. Swanson, sorry.
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and Representative Draskowski, the Border Cities Development Zone program provides a variety of tax reductions to the cities that Representative Lean mentioned that are along the North Dakota and South Dakota border. The types of tax reductions that are allowed under the law are quite broad, and the cities have a lot of flexibility with how they administer these reductions. As to the question about the surplus or the balance of the current funds, that should be in the handouts with that go along with the bill.
Yep. I just discovered it.
So you can see, I guess, the beginning balance is in 2017 and 2018 for each city, as well as appropriations in the last couple of years.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you can see, the program does currently have resources in it. A couple things to take into consideration, though, are Morehead. The city of Morehead has committed some of those dollars to some businesses for some projects. They haven't exactly spent those dollars yet, so that's a part of it. Plus, the fact that we do have some money in there, coupled with the ongoing appropriations, it really speaks to my point about long-term sustainability, so the city can do more planning around more development, specifically in the downtown Morehead. And Ms. Bodie does have specifics about Morehead's current funding, too.
Ms. Bodie.
Thank you very much. I'll note that there have been historically between 2 and 5 years between appropriations. So we are, as we make commitments to businesses, it is important to be able to have a resource available to offer multi-year commitments to those businesses, because it does take a few years for those, to start up, and a one-year incentive is very difficult. I know that my colleague at the City of East Grand Forks, who was not able to be here tonight because of weather-related travel concerns, has indicated they have made their program into a one-year incentive, which is not as helpful to enticing a business to make a decision to locate in Minnesota versus North Dakota, as a one-year incentive instead of multi-year. We do, as it pertains to Morehead, we do have commitments to a number of businesses, and we are in the process of paying out our workers' compensation credits to businesses that receive a portion of their workers' compensation premiums back. So we have partial credit of the 2018 tax year payable 2019 funds distributed. That amount for payable 2019 is $400,000, and we have resources available to pay those credits for 2020 as well, $400,000, and then we have an uncommitted project-based new development fund that we retained for $500,000. So we have an estimated balance remaining after taking in account of all of those commitments and reserves of $412,000 and change. So that, you know, as we look toward a sustainable appropriation, that would help us budget and plan.
Thank you, Ms. Bode. Any other questions? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think it's early in the meeting tonight, so I'll just say this once and we can imply it later. But the reality is that this tax reduction, basically, or a tax credit, really is exemplified more in border cities when there's a comparison, direct comparison between in-state and out-state competition. And this particular bill is in regards to tax credits, which implies that it is part of the tax policy that is making it less competitive, because giving those tax reductions out there makes it more competitive. And all I will say with that is that, whereas it may not be as evident when we're not in border cities, I think tax policy in Minnesota is a factor in our competitiveness with other states, even throughout the rest of the state. And so where I think this is certainly important for us to do for border cities, I think it's also important to remember that it is having a tax implication effect in other communities as well throughout the state. And whatever we could do to be more competitive in regards to our whole tax structure is certainly beneficial. So try to be as kind as I can.
Thank you, Representative Hertas, and then we're going to wrap this one up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lee. And I was hoping that I was going to be able to present in front of you, because I know you're going to leave right away and not listen to my story. Thank you for what you're doing. In the spirit of wanting to do what's best for the area that you represent, I get that part of what you're doing. But I was wondering if you could identify for me, with regard to the competition in the border scenario that you have with Fargo, if you were able to put your finger on one or two issues that were probably the most challenging to be competitive with regard to taxes or the competition that you're facing, could you identify what might be the biggest difference?
Representative
Lane. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Veritas. I mean, overall, taxes in general, you really get into it, things like utility rates, property taxes, land costs. You know, it does get to be more equitable when you spread it out across the entire business climate landscape. But, I mean, taxes overall are generally the issue that's at hand here. And I would just say to that between North Dakota and Minnesota, it's a night and day difference. I mean, it's just the difference is much more dramatic, I think, than between Minnesota and Wisconsin, we'll say. And to that, you know, I would say, well, I don't really support or think we should be trying to get into a race to the bottom, so to speak, as far as the lowest rates and just what that would mean. I know we've had some conversations in the tax committee about taxes and education, healthcare, and down the line and everything, but those conversations are real. And so if we were going to be having to take a look at that just on a very comprehensive basis, I think as far as state policy, we do have to take into consideration all of those other things. So, like I say, I don't think we should be getting into a race to the bottom with North Dakota. You know, I think it's good that we keep our services strong, we keep education strong. I mean, I've said this in tax committee before, that when I talk with businesses, the biggest concern they have is finding workers out there, you know. So, that's I guess what I would say to that.
Representative Hertz has one more comment, and then we do have to move
Thank you. Well, what I was really hoping to hear, and I know you and I have talked with this, and you've been supportive in the past, but I don't think that the Fargo area has a state general levy, for example, on your business and CI property. And we know that in Minnesota that generally raises the base tax from county and school and local taxes by another 28% to 33%. So that certainly is something that I think I was wanting to hear you say that maybe that would be one of the issues. But thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Vang renews her motion that House File 1104 be laid over for consideration in the division report. Thank you so much, and safe travels as you drive back tonight.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
Great. And next we're going to take up House File 1131. Representative Keel, welcome to the Property Tax Division.
Madam Chair, I make a motion to move House File 1131 for possible inclusion division report.
Thank you, Representative Vang. The bill is before the committee, and please explain your proposal, Representative Kill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I really appreciate you hearing this. I think I might win the prize for bringing the constituent the farthest, and he would like to go home to a blizzard that we're expecting by...
Do you really want a blizzard?
Good. He'd appreciate the ice cream one rather than more snow, but anyway, such is life. So House File 1131 is a local government aid that East Grand Forks receives that is a little different. It's one of the unusual ones set by the pre-1940 housing percentage. And this bill basically is the same as we have done for years, except for we would like to move the housing from 1940 to 1970. And with that, I'm going to ask Mayor Gander to talk about East Grand Forks and the request and what it does for them. So.
Welcome to the committee, Mayor Nander. Please don't wish a blizzard or bad weather on the rest of us. Thank you. Please tell us about the proposal.
Thank you, Chair Loeffler. And my name again for the record, Steve Gander, Mayor of East Grand Forks. And good evening, and thank you for the opportunity to share information with you this evening about the bill that you're considering. And as many of you recall, in the year 1997, East Grand Forks had a flood that came across our whole city. And all of us were under mandatory evacuation for an average of about 21 days. Coming out of that event, many homes damaged beyond repair, and others had to be taken out for the levy that came through. And so thank you for the state's part in funding our levees protection system that we have. The flood of 1997 had a crest of 54 feet, and I've lived in that community since 1961. The highest we'd ever seen prior to that is 49 feet. So 49 to 54 is a double flowage to what was expected. They actually predicted 49 for that year, but 54. Now we're protected to 60 feet, and what a great feeling it is. Thank you to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and again, the state of Minnesota participated also in helping to fund that. Currently, we have 3,722 homes in the city of East Grand Forks, and nearly the same number now as we had before the flood, so folks have come back. We did lose 571 homes in the flood of 1997. And of those, 290 were built before the year 1940, so homes that we no longer have. These were the smaller, affordable starter homes that young couples could move into and start a family at an affordable price. And, of course, those are gone. And in our normal distribution of housing inventory that we might have had to offer to folks coming in, we no longer have those. And it's affected us right to this day. So in 2013, when you all did the last major update of the LGA bill here in the legislature, you put in a special provision for East Grand Forks such that we used the 1990 census for pre-1940 homes to get this number to the range of where LGA would behave as it should. For a few years, the LGA tracked about with our neighbors, Crookston and Thief River Falls, and about like held steady. But then over the last three consecutive years, including the projection for next year, we're losing about $80,000 to $100,000 each year. So something in our legislative fix stopped working. I mean, I've studied your spreadsheet, and I've studied what it looks like for tax capacity. It's above my pay grade to even figure out that doggone spreadsheet, let alone what numbers affect it. But all I know is the fix that was put in 13, which tracked pretty well for a few years, seems not to be working anymore for the three consecutive years. And so that's where we've come to this request. You know, tax capacity really should carry probably with earnings. With our neighbors, we're within about 5% of earnings, yet our home values were about 60% higher on average home. And it's all just because of the homes we lost in the flood. So the request that we've had then is to repair the legislative fix placed in the 2013 LGA law. Under our request, the homes referenced in the LGA formula would become then the pre-1970 homes. Our current population is around 8,700, and that's the number. The 1970 homes is the number used in cities of over 10,000. So in a way, you'd almost be bumping us to there to try to make it work. Now, what that would do, if you're curious, what that would do as to our LGA, it would actually only make up for two of the year's losses that we've had. And so two of those could be brought back and put in for the 2020 and beyond. And so we're not looking to make any big windfall. And in fact, two of the three losses would still be there, but only to some way stop the loss and level it out to where it might just track kind of with what our neighbors have. And because of the challenge that it puts on our local government to try to make that budget work in that environment of losing that. And again, it really does go back to that 97 flood and the fix that didn't sustain very well, the aberration that took place and the fix that didn't stay fixed.
Thank you, Mayor. And questions, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Mayor. Just a quick question. The 570 homes that were removed as a part of the federal program, what is existing there right now? Were the streets and the sewer and water, was all of that capped off and abandoned? What happened with all that infrastructure?
It's an excellent Mayor. Question. Oh, sorry, ma'am. The one little area in the area which we call Sherlock Park now is a state campground. And what I'm told, it's about the number two campground in the state for usership. Many of those did have to be the foundations taken out, the streets eliminated. They are on the wet side of a levee. Many of them actually are under a levee or under a flood wall. So they had to way over excavate, big deep V down to undisturbed soil, which would be stable for the dike or flood wall and back up. So they will never be built on. They are either on the wet side or they're under the levee, unstable soils, damaged beyond repair. So really the vast majority were in the floodplain or in the footprint of the levee.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thanks for bringing this bill forward. You know, in 2013, city folks came together and came up with a formula, and the credibility of the program is to have a formula that has a real basis. But at the same time, there are certain cities and certain conditions that just don't fit. And here's a situation where you had this massive flood, which I remember very well the day Grand Forks and East Grand Forks and Ada and Breckenridge all were going down about a couple of weeks apart. But here they lost a number of homes by a disaster, which has changed the characteristic of that city for this formula purpose. And so this isn't going to be the only bill. There's going to be other bills coming up that kind of fall in the same thing. May not be a disaster, but has certain situations that just don't fall into the formula. So I certainly support this and appreciate Representative Keogh bringing this forward.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Vang renews her motion that House File 1131 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Madam Loeffler.
Thank you, Chair, for hearing this sooner.
Great. And next we'll go to House File 1458, Representative Sandsted.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move 1458 for before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you, Representative Vang, and welcome to the committee, Representative Sandsted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Before you have House File 1458. This is a request for increase in the sparsity for the City of Hibbing. I would like to thank Representative Marquard for the beautiful segue into this bill, because this is a situation exactly that falls into the category of a unique situation. With me today, I have City Administrator Tom Dicklage to tell you more of why we need this.
Welcome to the committee, City Administrator. Sorry, I'm going to get you back into an elected office. It's good to see you again, Mr. Tucker.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much for having me today. I appreciate the opportunity. Just talk about House File 1458. Thank you also in advance. I know this committee has taken up larger LGA bills, and that's talked about LGA increases and other things that are important to not just rural Minnesota, but all Minnesota. So in House File 1458, this is a sparsity adjustment, as Representative Marquardt and Representative Sansa talked about these unique situations. You know, HIPPING has been trying I've been up there 6.5 years. We've been trying to figure out what we can do to boost our LGA. We kind of fell flat back in, from 2015 on. We had 1 year that we got a $42,000 increase, but the rest have been, $3,000, and last year was $2,200. We have a lot of unique situations up there, and we're just trying to fit somewhere. But, ours is, we're 186 square miles. You take that in terms of Ramsey County is 170 square miles. We can't change in the past in the late 70s when they thought that we should annex these other townships to get that big. So, we have a population of 16,000 people, and we need to provide services. We have a lot of roads, and I have the stats somewhere. I can look them up if you need them. And we have to be able to provide these services. So, like I said, I'm not sure if this is the right solution. We just want to be part of the conversation with this committee as you go forward, and we don't want to be left out of the loop and left behind.
Great. Any questions for our witnesses or Representative Sandstead? If not, thank you so much. Any concluding remarks?
Thank you for hearing the bill, and we ask for your support moving forward.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Vang renews her motion that House File 1458 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. And Representative Sandstead, while you're there, why don't you present House File 1599?
Madam Chair, I move to bring 1599 before the committee and for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you very much. And Representative Sandstead, why don't you and your testifiers explain this proposal?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1599, again, falls in the category of unique situations. This is a bill requesting an LGA increase for the city of Floodwood, a very, very, very small community with extreme financial needs. Tonight, I have Mayor Dave DeNoyer with me and City Administrator Jess Rich to talk more about those needs.
Welcome to the committee. Mayor, please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Dave DeNoyer, Mayor of Floodwood. And thank you, Chair Loeffler and committee members for hearing us out tonight. The city of Floodwood is 1.2 square miles in size and has a population of 528. We're located at the intersection of U.S. Highway 2 and State Highway 73 in St. Louis County. We're approximately 40 miles west of Duluth and 30 miles east of Grand Rapids. City of Floodwood is asking for $35,000 increase in local government aid payable in 2020 and thereafter. Floodwood has a household median income of only $24,722 compared with St. Louis County's $50,936. Our median property value is $56,400 compared to St. Louis County's $143,200. HUD has us listed as a low and moderate income status community of 68.4%. 18% of our city is tax exempt or tax forfeited property, so we can't collect taxes on it. We have the second highest tax rate in St. Louis County. Floodwood operates on a bare bone budget of $606,000. This includes bond payments, streets, maintenance, administration, clerical, fire, and police. We have no budget reserves, and we're 30 to 40 miles away from any community to pair or share services with. So this makes it quite difficult, and it gives us no room in our budget for error. Without extra funding, it puts us at a disadvantage. We need to keep our city safe, clean, good streets, and still have a tax structure that we can attract housing and businesses. We are surrounded by larger communities that are all growing, and we could do the same if we could get funded. In 2013, our local government aid was $133,152. In 2019, 7 years later, it was $160,356. It was a total increase over 7 years of $27,204. In some years, 2016, our increase, our local government aid increase was $675. In 2017, it was $362. And in 2019, it was $327. But like any small city, we're very appreciative of any amount and any increase we receive, because no small city can survive without local government aid. We're asking for this increase because our yearly unexpected expenditures, water main breaks, unfunded mandates, emergency repairs, and increased fees for services. It's just impossible to keep up with these additional expenses with our current funding levels. This is forcing us to obtain a tax anticipation loan to cover our expenses this year. And paying on borrowed money will only add to our debt. Recently, we've made cuts to all departments, and we've raised taxes and fees, and we're still falling short. We don't have extra funds to do anything that will help us increase our tax base. This year, due to four unexpected water main breaks at about $20,000 each, the break has put our water fund $60,000 in the red. This has also put a strain on our general budget. We have raised water and sewer rates 100% in the last 3 years, and it'll still take us years to dig out of the hole. Raising taxes to the highest in the county will not allow us to attract additional businesses or new housing. We hope you consider this moderate increase. Although it seems small in comparison to what larger cities receive, this would allow our city to become financially solvent and lower the tax burden to our residents. And we thank you. We're open to any questions.
Thank you, Mayor DeNoyer. And your final witness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jessica Rich, and I am the City Administrator in Floodwood. Just to share one number with you, between 2014 and 2017, we have spent $72,000 down in our general fund. So in just 3 short years, it's catching up with us. I've been the City Administrator in Floodwood for 20 years, and it has never been more difficult to have a balanced budget than it is now. So we appreciate any help and assistance that you can give us.
Thank you. And any questions from members? Seeing none, any concluding remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Vang renews the motion that House File 1599 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Very much.
And next, Representative Murphy, House File 969.
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 969 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you. And Representative Murphy, I understand you have an A1 amendment to remove that at this time, too?
Please. I would like to move the A1 amendment.
And the A1 amendment is before us. It looks pretty small and technical. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is not the first time that I have come before you to talk about LGA or the City of Hermantown. The City of Hermantown is my life home. I live in the house I was born into, and Hermantown's been in existence for this century and last century, and it became a city in 1976. And at that time, they had almost 5,000 people population, and now the City of Hermantown has almost 10,000 population. And comparison to the last two cities, we have growing pains, and we have a very frugal budget and many advantages, but we have no LGA. And I asked Ms. Dalton to help, and we had a solution 1 year, and then we had another solution, and now today we come with another solution. And I would like to have Ms. Dalton explain it without emotion.
You care about your city. I think we all care about our cities. Ms. Dalton from House Research.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Hermantown does have a history of having gotten an extra $200,000 a year of aid beginning back in 1995. What happened was the city had one of the highest tax rates in St. Louis County, and it had to do with the fact that that city received no disparity reduction aid and no taconite aid, and was the only city in the county that received neither. And so its share of the county taxes was almost double what the county taxes were anyplace else in the state. So this city was granted a $200,000 aid increase. It was added to their HACA to essentially offset that disparity in the county aid. When HACA went away, that money was moved to the LGA program. When the grandfathers went away in the LGA program, this one was retained in 2003. It was one of the grandfathers that was retained in 2003, but when the formula was redone in 2013, this grandfather went away.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Any questions from members? Any concluding remarks, Representative Murphy?
Please help.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Bang renews her motion that House File 969, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have House File 949, Representative Hansen, Lilydale proposal.
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 949 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you, Representative Bang. Welcome to the committee, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 949 has been heard in this committee before and actually was included in last year's tax bill that was vetoed. And you may remember that testimony. We had several of the Lilydale city councilors with us. Today I have just one, but the best one, I think, Councilor Deal. And just the short summary of this is, those of you who have been to Little Lilydale, where Moose Country used to be but is no longer, but you may have been to Bongiorno or crossed over the river, that Highway 13 redo that you have driven on resulted in the stormwater need that the city of Lilydale had to pay for with the Highway 13 redo. And the city of Lilydale does not receive any local government aid, and as a city of about
923 strong souls.
I thought my vote total had gone up there. But
that's because they helped you out.
So they don't have a big budget, and this was a surprise, and actually the cost has gone up from what the bill is. This is what the bill was last year, and the cost has actually gone up. We're asking for $275,000 as a one-time LGA adjustment to help them. And Councilor Deal could describe what's happened for them.
Welcome to the committee, Councilor Deal.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is John Deal. I'm the Assistant Mayor. Mayor Warren Peterson wanted to be with us tonight, but the change in the schedule from yesterday canceled him out of our team. I wanted to just very briefly cover a little bit about the geography of Lilydale, our population and its demographics, and then this project. As Representative Hansen said, Lilydale does not normally receive local government aid. We feel that we do as good a job as we can in managing our little town, and so it's an extraordinary circumstance that brings us here with this request. Lilydale is about a mile and a half long along Highway 13 in northern Dakota County. We are the south bank of the Mississippi River across from St. Paul. Most of the structures and population of Lilydale occupy the area west of Interstate 35E. So if you picture Highway 13, 35E, most of Lilydale is the approximately quarter mile between 13 and the river, which, if you think of it, is a bluff. And along that bluff is most of Lilydalians, as we call ourselves. We have 923 citizens. One-third of our whole town lives in a senior housing project that came online a few years ago. I don't know what that's done to our demographic. Before that, Lilydale had an average age of 61. The average age of Minnesotans at that time was 31. This reveals to you that we are a very homogeneous population. The stereotype is true that most people are in a retirement mode. I think we have a very stable community in terms of economics and so on, but the point that we're sensitive to as on the City Council is that our people, almost all of whom, we only have four single-family homes in our town. People live in apartments, condos, townhouses, and they are not in a position at this stage of life to handle economic surprises. And so we try to be very stable in our government and in the way we tax our citizens. I think that we are responsible citizens. I don't think that we have more than, at the most, a dozen children in our whole town, but Lilydale votes for the school district bond issues every time. So we try to do our share. Our people, I think, do a good job. And so, if you picture this nice little town on the banks of the Mississippi River, and you see that from Old Highway 110 to the river is downhill, all the water that comes out of the ground or falls from the sky in that area flows to the river, and its last crossing point before it hits the Mississippi is Lilydale. So this creates a certain amount of surface water challenges, and we've been trying to cope with this. The people that live along there's four principal condo buildings along the bluff. Those developments have spent in the last 5 years something like $300,000 of the homeowners associations to deal with their management of surface water, holding ponds, etc. And so this problem, management of surface water, was something we started to attack when the highway department wanted to upgrade Highway 13 from a rural model to an urban model, i.e. curbs and storm sewers. And we seized upon that to upgrade our storm sewer along that whole stretch, about half of the town along 13. That project, the highway department pays for storm sewer construction based on what they calculate the runoff of the hard surface they're building, which of course in this situation is a very small part of the total water. So when they did that, we stepped up and we paid to expand the capacity of the sewers that were being built as a part of that project. Of course, once you do that, all you've done is capture the water. So we had a second component of this project of transporting the water from along the where it's caught off the highway, away from the highway toward the river. And the third part of that project was to build a drop shaft sewer that takes the water down to the river. And the total cost of that project was approximately $1,320,000. You couldn't audit these numbers, but these are our estimates. Let's just say that the state piece was $350,000, and our piece of that first project was $445,000. In addition, the construction of the sewer from the highway over to this drop shaft and the building of the drop shaft was $425,000, and then the contractor there This is what's so much fun about being on a city council. I don't know if you've ever done this, but so this contractor claims that we were not diligent enough in predicting the soil consistency as he bored down to the river, and he lost his equipment in a collapse of this anyway, $100,000 cost overrun, lawsuit, settled it for $100,000. So we end up with $1.3 million less the state's part, $970,000. And we have built up a sanitary sewer reserve and a storm sewer reserve, and we depleted all of our storm sewer reserve. We borrowed from our sanitary sewer reserve, and we've paid all of this off except for $312,000. And I suppose we did, maybe shouldn't rely on the state, but psychologically, when the state appropriated the $275,000 last year, we built that into our budget. We figured we had to finance another rough, whatever that is, $50,000 or something. And then, of course, the state, that bill got vetoed. So we're here again, the same story. We're hoping that you will give us this one-time grant to take care of this extraordinary expense. We didn't feel we could assess the property owners because they had already spent $300,000 with the work that they did. And as I say, it's hard to raise fees when you know that almost 100% of your population are living on retirement incomes. So we're asking for this one-time grant, which was passed last year, but then ended up going over.
Thank you, Councilor Deal. Any questions for our witness or Representative Hansen? If not, any concluding comments, Representative Hansen?
Just asking for your support. This was in the bill last year. I think it was an important piece of that. And Lilydale doesn't. I encourage you to visit and to Lilydale and try to make it. It's very close, but this would be very helpful if we could get this for the city.
That's correct.
And with that, Representative Vang renews her motion that House File 949 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Thank you. And Representative Hansen, House File 461.
Madam Chair, I move House File 461 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in division report.
Thank you, Representative Vang, for that motion. And Representative Hansen, please explain your proposal for the City of West St. Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is also a bill that I think has been heard in this committee before in prior sessions, and this relates to the construction of a state highway that goes through the middle of West St. Paul. I want to note that West St. Paul is not St. Paul. West St. Paul is west of South St. Paul, but south of St. Paul. And it is a separate city of about 20,000 people. And it has 20,000 great people in the city, but it has incurred massive debt as related to the construction of the state highway through the middle of it. And as those of you who are returning members know, I have tried for many years to get support for Robert Street. This is a model that has precedent that has been used before with other communities paying for debt, and the dollars, the $3.68 million that is in the state will be from the state general fund for debt mitigation. That number comes from the cost for traffic signals. Generally, when there is a state highway, the state picks up the cost for the traffic signals. There are four traffic signals in West St. Paul and Robert Street that the city had to pay for as well, in addition to most of the project. So that $3.68 million is something that almost everywhere else is covered by the state for traffic signals. I have with me Councillor Dick Vitale. We may be joined by Councillor John Justin, and I think there are some constituents here as well asking for assistance going to the city of West St. Paul. With that, I turn it to Councillor Vitale.
Welcome to the committee, Councillor Vitale. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi.
And then proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Dick Vitale, lifelong resident of West St. Paul.
I've been a counselor for 20 years in the city of West St. Paul. Robert Street, Highway 952A, was a rebuild that we proceeded with, and I believe we started in June of 15. It turned out to be a very expensive project with the closure of many driveways for businesses in order to meet MnDOT standards with the center median, and we ran into thousands of yards of muck that had to be trucked out and bring new soil in to get the highway up to the proper standards. Typical cost sharing, Rick has mentioned this, between local and state and federal state trunk highway projects, cities typically cover maybe 30% with an average share of up to 16%. In this case, our funds covered 65% of the project. Our taxpayers are paying 65% of the rebuild on that highway. Our West St. Paul, let's see, we had 11 traffic signals, as Representative Hansen said, that got rebuilt. We replaced all of them, so, and we paid for them on a state highway. We've got a typical home, $200,000 home in West St. Paul, is going to pay, over the life of these bonds, 15 years, is going to pay $4,900. A $500,000 commercial property over the life of these 15 years for these bonds is going to pay $63,000. We really need some help on that highway project to pay that debt relief, and that's why we're asking. West St. Paul does not have the property wealth that many may assume. In comparison with 28 greater Minnesota cities of similar size, West St. Paul tax capacity in 2016 was 3% lower than the mean, while the household income was 5% lower than the mean. In comparison with 39 metro cities of similar size, West St. Paul tax capacity, again in 2016, was 26% lower than the mean, while our household income was 35% lower than the mean. West St. Paul was basically built after World War II. We're fully developed. We're in a redevelopment mode at this point. We are making good progress. The improvements to Highway 952A, Robert Street, were great improvements to our city, but our citizens are really burdened with a heavy debt. We've had to raise our taxes much higher than we wanted to. We've always been a very fiscally conservative city, tried to do the right thing, and it doesn't feel well to have $54 million in debt hanging over our head.
Thank you, Councilor Vitale, and we have a question from Representative Bernardi.
First of all, Madam Chair, is there going to be more testimony on this bill, or is this it?
This will be it for tonight.
Okay. I want to say I do feel really bad for West St. Paul. Representative Hansen has worked very, very hard on this.
I know he has.
And I've done a lot of work with MnDOT, and their practices weren't so. They're getting a lot better, and this what didn't seem just. And to think that you're paying for the street lights through your city and 63% of a state project on a highway is absurd. And so I hope it's time is due that West St. Paul gets reimbursed for some of these costs and help reduce that burden. So I just want to give a shout out to Representative Hansen for working hard on this, and I hope this legislature finds a way to address this issue.
On behalf of the citizens of West St. Paul, I do too.
Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of in that vein, Representative Hansen, have you looked at working with Representative Bernardi and others on getting this through the transportation bill? This is kind of an obtuse approach.
Representative Hansen.
In a tax bill.
Madam Chair and Representative Draskowski, we've tried everything. We tried bonding, we've tried over the years. We've tried cash and bonding. The project is done. So we can't bond, can't get cash. Transportation won't do it. It's not a turn back. So this is like the last chance of trying to get some way. And I want to be clear, there is precedent for this that has been done with other communities of long-term LGA payback. That's been done in other communities, and Ms. Dalton, we've got the memo from 2 years ago, or was it 4 years ago? We introduced this last session, so
So with that, Madam
Representative Chair, Drazkowski.
Representative Hansen said there's precedent for the 15-year payback, but the straight-out cash check from the Department of Revenue, is there a precedent for that?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I am not sure that I can name a precedent for Section 2 of this bill. For Section 1, we've done this for both the City of Coon Rapids and for the City of Baxter.
Thank you. And seeing no other questions, I did have a question in that you have a proposal for a local option sales tax before the division as well. Can you tell us how these relate?
So the local option sales tax, Madam Chair, is going to pay for things in the future. As Councilor Vitale said, the $54 million in debt is a massive debt load for the City of West St. Paul. So it's impacting a variety of other things that the city is or is not able to do, whether it's inflow infiltration, whether it's the debt capacity to do any other bonding is very impacted. So the sales tax helps from this point forward to do streets that are, and I'd invite you to drive into West St. Paul and particularly along Smith and Annapolis, kind of that area that's shared with Ramsey County and Dakota County and the City of St. Paul, and just see the difference when you cross the road ability. So that sales tax, when we testified, that names some specific streets that have yet to be done. They're not Robert Street. It's future needs.
If I may. Typically we do 3 to 4 miles, I believe, in a year of reconstruction. And this is going to set us way back. You know, our road conditions are deteriorating just as everybody else's are. And we want to be able to do those projects, but this Robert Street debt has really saddled us with, and we sanitary sewer issues, pumping stations that we need to rebuild, I mean, to keep our infrastructure strong and safe and secure. These are all projects that have been in the works and been planning for, and this burden of debt on the state highway really has thrown a wrench into our financial work.
Well, thank you. And with that, Representative Vang renews her motion that House Bill 461 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, committee members. Thank you.
House File 2031, Representative Hertas. And Representative Hertas, you can move your bill to bring it before the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 2031 to the General Register.
That's not the appropriate motion.
All right. I'm just seeing if you're paying attention. All right. Madam Chair, I'll amend my motion to move House File 2031 to be a possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you for that. And why don't you describe your proposal?
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, we have been listening to a number of long local government aid bills. And this issue of local government aid has been a perennial problem for the 7 years that I'm serving in this committee. But my interest in this issue really began 16 years ago in local government. And it became inherently clear to me about some of the systemic problems with LGA, and I would like to indulge the members for me to just kind of give you a brief overview of the history of LGA. LGA was
Representative Hertas, we've got a lot of bills today. We did that actually on LGA Day a little bit, so just a condensed
version.
Yeah,
I will condense it. 47 years ago, LGA was enacted, and the basic formula in 1972 is that every city in the state received LGA. When LGA was enacted, it was enacted, and levy limits locally were imposed upon the communities. during the 1970s and 80s, a city could choose to exceed that levy limit but was willing to pay a penalty of not receiving LGA. Kind of fast-forwarding to what was going on, by 1986, there were 13 cities that were receiving zero LGA, but then that number grew significantly to 83 cities by 1992. Then in 1992, the LGA formulas were changed for the purpose of basically grandfathering in all LGA appropriations that were part of the formula, and then the remaining amount of money that was appropriated under LGA was distributed via the formula that we have been tinkering with for the last 30 years. The problem has been is that in these decades, we constantly are needing to reform the LGA because communities continue to get bumped off of the LGA formula. And we've heard other communities here tonight that face that same problem. In 2003, the LGA formula was tweaked again, and it basically eliminated all of the grandfathered LGA numbers that cities previously received. From that time on, it continued to be a problem. It corrected a problem for a while, but then it continued to grow. And so where we are currently is we have 95 cities in Minnesota that represent 20% of the state's population. 1.3 million people in the state of Minnesota are living or residing in communities that do not receive any LGA. I'd like to point out that these 95 cities, there are 66 of those cities are Class 4 cities, meaning that they have populations under 10,000 people. There are 8 cities that are between 10 and 20,000. Hermantown is soon approaching on that number as well. And then there are about 24 cities that are larger, or Class 2 cities that are larger than that. I'd like to pass around a flow chart. I would like to have you understand what this bill does. This bill does what none of the other bills have done, and that is it seeks to kind of return to both the regular formula that we have and also an alternative formula that will ensure that every community is participating in the LGA formula. And what it essentially does in the way the bill is structured is it fully funds the governor's budget request of $30 million additionally to the LGA formula. Now, members, the 2019 certified LGA is $535 million. It adds $30 million to that formula and or to that appropriation. And then you will see, according to the chart there that I prepared for you, it takes 2% of that total appropriation and moves it into an alternative formula for communities that no longer qualify for LGA under the old formula that has been used for the last 47 years with some modifications. So what that means, if you look at the flow chart there, is that about $11.2 million is set aside as an alternative formula. It increases the current certified appropriation from 535, adds about another 20 million, and so you'll see about $555 million. So then from the alternative formula, what it does is it has a base aid, which is calculated on a per capita, per population with a cap. So it's capped at a maximum of $60,000 of aid. And then after all of that aid is appropriated for qualifying cities, then the remainder of that 2% reserve or set aside is then distributed on a per capita basis divided by all of the population of the sum of all the cities. So when you run the two numbers together, the maximum amount of aid that any city would receive, combining base aid and per capita aid, is about $47 and some change per capita. And it dwindles down to as little as $2 of aid per capita. So what I'm proposing here is to end once and for all the inequities that have been occurring where 20% of the population in the state of Minnesota has been contributing to the state general fund through its sales tax and economic activity for the state general levy that is assessed and collected in their communities that their citizens pay. Many of the communities are also fiscal disparities losers, and a lot of these cities are under 5,000 that do not receive any MSAH dollars. Now, there's been a number of communities that have been sliding off of LGA. I mentioned to you earlier that next year it's estimated to be about 100 or 101 communities that will be off formula. And this trend will continue unless we do something about it. So what I'm proposing is a new alternative approach. Under the bill as proposed with the new appropriation, no community will have their LGA go down as a result of this bill. Some of the communities, because of the formula, the old formula and the way it's working, some of them, with or without this bill, their LGA is going to go down a little bit. And you'll see some of that on spreadsheets that were provided in the packet. But there are communities all around, you know, small towns, Hermantown, Wake Park, St. Mary's Point, Waukon. It's not just metro communities. They're all across the Twin Cities. And I'm most proud and happy that this is a very bipartisan bill. We've got a number of authors on both sides of the aisle, including our tax chair, Representative Marquardt, Representative Lehman and Purcell, Representative Murphy, and others that are supporting this bill. And it is a reality that these communities, despite some of the characteristics often described by them, all these communities do have needs. And the funding is always an issue. And this would be create a regular and sustainable, predictable amount of income stream. Often, for many of them, might mean an extra police officer if they have a police department. And in closing, Madam Chair, I would just like to characterize some of the communities that I represent in District 33A. Yes, it's Hennepin County, but we're very rural. Many of you would find it difficult that in a half an hour from here you would be driving in the communities that I represent that have 35 miles of gravel road to maintain within their city. That is the case with Corcoran. In Greenfield, there's 33, and Independence, there's 23 miles. And we have, because of restrictive regional or metropolitan planning organization known as Met Council, these communities also have a great handicap in that they're not permitted to grow as the marketplace would permit them. And many of these communities would like to grow and would like to grow rooftops and would like to be able to grow their city budgets, but they cannot because they're stuck in a situation where land use is restricted by the Metropolitan Council and the comprehensive plans. So although this does address some of the concerns of the communities I represent, it represents and solves problems all across the state, all 95 cities. And if we don't do something about it, there'll be 100 of them next year. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to remain for any questions that members have. But I'm very excited about the bipartisan support for this bill. And I'm also very excited about the reality that 20% of the state's population is asking under this proposal for 2% of the total appropriation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Hewitt has a question or a comment.
I'm not used to these microphones. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hurtas, I have to say that this created some excitement in my community today as my city has received an email on this exact subject. And so I have a lot of questions about this, actually. So I have two fairly decent cities that don't receive LGA right now, but I have one that has is right on the, I think they receive some, but they're going to need more because they have a well problem. And I don't, this is cities versus equity versus non-equity, and I'm a little concerned about this with my cities. And being a new freshman, it's hard to explain this to them about, you know, it sounds good to them, but at the same token, the city of Coates right now has polluted wells, and we're going to have to figure out how to fix them. And so how does a city like that pay without LGA? And kind of help me out here a little bit.
Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Huat, again, to emphasize, this is bringing new money or new revenue to cities who have been off formula since 2003 and even some longer than that. So this is not shifting or taking money away from any other community. This is actually new money in an alternative formula. By the base appropriation that I'm putting forward of $30 million, it increases LGA from the current formula to all of those cities that are receiving LGA under the old formula. And all of the communities would have to go through that process first. If they qualify for the old formula, you know, that doesn't change anything, and they still would see a net increase because of the $20 million appropriation. It's just that one-third of this new appropriation is set aside to include cities that don't get anything.
Right. And I'm, Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative,
and I'm stuck on that. So this is $30 million of new money out of the general fund that we have to come up with. Is that right? Or
That is correct. It's $30 million out of the general fund. The general fund, which is contributed to by every community, all 835 cities in this state. And it is the full amount that the governor is requesting in his appropriation for new LGA funding.
And one last question, and I'll finish up there. Was this presented in the last session?
Representative Hurtas.
No, Madam Chair, thank you for that. Thank you for the question, Representative Huat. I have been trying to figure out a way to fix this problem for 7 years. And I want to thank Mrs. Dalton for assisting me. I contacted her with kind of an epiphany one day. I had a new idea, and together we worked on different things. And what we worked on together collaboratively was to make sure that this wasn't regressive to certain communities. And it's actually set up kind of progressive in that in the 95 cities that I've set up in this formula, the largest per capita aid goes to the smallest cities and continues to decrease based on your size and goes right down to a very minimal contribution. But in fairness and equity, I felt it was necessary that every community be able to participate in the way this program was set up in the very beginning, 47 years ago. And it was distributed. Basically, I think it was, maybe Ms. Dalton can correct me, but I think it was 0.5% of the total sales tax revenue at that time was dedicated to be distributed on a per capita basis to every community in the city. But maybe I defer to Ms. Dalton to correct me if I said that wrong.
Representative Hurtas.
Madam Chair, Representative Hurtas, actually, when LGA was set up, it did replace a number of revenue sharing sources, not the half cent sales tax. Okay. That was actually something that occurred back in the 1990s when we had the non-optional local option sales tax.
Well, and thank you for that. I think we're going to focus on going forward because there's all kinds of interpretations of history I have heard in this debate. Representative Herr has a question.
Yeah, and maybe my question is off base because I am just learning, you know, now and trying to get an understanding of LGA formula. And when I was with the city, I was really interested in LGA. And so our Office of Financial Services sat with me and we looked at the formula and I asked how, if you move one piece of something, how it changes everything else, right? And I was told that the formula was so complex that all the questions I was asking was actually, it would cause more problems than it would actually fix the things I was looking at. And you know, we were always trying to figure out, like, because, you know, everyone's always looking for more funds, right? And so I guess what I'm concerned about this is I was always looking at it as like a mathematical formula. And so when it's laid out in this way, it's a little bit harder for me because I'm a numbers person. So it's a little bit harder for me to sort of see, you know, when you're doing the work, when changing one factor and how that impacts all the other pieces that make up the LGA formula. So I'm just curious from this, I mean, how would adopting this revision of the formula affect cities that have the most unmet needs? Because the purpose of LGA is really, the formula is written to emphasize unmet needs. And I know that you're saying that it's not regressive, but I just feel like there's so much complexity to this formula, and there were all these little pieces that have been put in over the years to sort of address some of these pieces, and I guess I'm concerned that does this actually do what it is that we think it's going to do?
Right? I think we'll ask Ms. Dalton to answer that.
And Madam Chair, I guess I would like to address that, and I would like to have Ms. Dalton chime in on it. But again, I need to emphasize that it does not change the old formula in any way for the communities that are currently on LGA. So it doesn't change the unmet need and doesn't pit one city against the other. That has been the challenge that I've faced for 7 years with trying to figure out a plan for this. How can we implement a plan that will add benefit and aid to all of the communities that participate in our One Minnesota theme that the governor is promoting? How do we include 20%, I'm sorry, 16% of communities that comprise 95 cities, how do we include them in One Minnesota? And so the formula that I put forth is basically just setting aside 2% of the total appropriation as an alternative formula for cities that do not qualify under the present formula that has been in place. So it doesn't attempt to tweak or modify the old formula. It's not attempting to disrupt anything that cities are currently receiving. And with the additional appropriation that is also kept into the pot of the old formula, every community will actually be increasing their LGA distribution as a result of this bill, with the exception of some communities who, like Hermantown and some of these other communities that were kind of grew out of the LGA program. This is why we have this continual problem where under the old formula, which I believe is antiquated, it doesn't address the unmet needs. How do you define unmet needs? Well, we got this formula about how many houses you have that are pre-1940. Does that really address unmet needs? When you've got communities that have limited capacity to grow their revenues, they're all unmet needs in terms of, you know, providing the basic services of police and fire. And a lot of these communities are doing the best they can. They have joint powers agreement with other communities with regard to fire protection. They may be a contract with other communities for police service. They don't have their own police department. And I want to point out, and just in contrast, when you look at the LGA runs, there are many communities around this great state that are receiving nearly $500, $460, $470, $480 per capita of local government aid. And what I'm talking about in this alternative formula is not providing any more than $47 of aid to any of the communities that are currently not on the formula. Ms. Dalton, I'd be happy to have you follow up with an answer to
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, actually Representative Hurtas did a fabulous job of explaining this. Basically what this is saying is of the $30 million more that this bill, the governor's bill, everybody else is proposing adding to LGA, we're going to take an amount that would be equivalent to 2% of the total amount and putting it into a new formula. So the remaining 98% of it will be distributed as it is under the current law. It won't change anybody's, how much anybody else would get under that, other than the fact that to ensure that there are no cliffs between a city, as a city approaches getting zero aid, the least amount that they can get will be what they can get under this alternative formula. So if a city has enough tax base to meet entirely all of their unmet need, or really close to their unmet need, so they would actually get less than what this alternative formula would give them, they would get that alternative formula amount instead. But it does not change. If a city is far away from being able to meet its unmet need under its current appropriation, LGA, and its tax base, if you put more money into the program, it will continue to get a greater share of that pot.
Ms. Dalton, though, isn't it true that if you had a lesser amount for the on-formula cities, they would get a lesser amount because $11.5 million is going to the new formula?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
So it's a different use of the proposed $30 million increase in a little different allocation between those who are on formula and those who would be coming on Representative Hurtas's proposal, new formula.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, that is correct. And I looked at the fiscal note that had that statement, and I thought to myself, well, how can you argue that it made it sound like a burden was being shifted away from other communities when you're adding $20 million of money that has never been in the formula before, and we're increasing the appropriation, nobody gets a cut or isn't being shifted. Yes, it would be true if all of the money simply went to the old formula, then everybody would get a little bit more. But the problem is that we continue to see this rising problem of communities going off formula, and this is really a safety net that I've designed into this formula that will prevent communities from going off. Even like the situation we just heard earlier tonight with Lilydale, they would have an appropriation that would allow them to address their needs in that aging population on fixed income. This is the type of thing that I was working hard for these last many years to come up with some way that we could address this. And being that we're in a surplus and we have an absolute opportunity with additional appropriation and probably not a good reason why we can't do this. We don't have targets yet, but let's assume that this would happen. This is a perfect time to implement this formula because there's no pain to anyone. Nobody's going to suffer under this proposal.
Representative Herr, any other questions?
I could just talk to you offline about this because I guess as I'm thinking about the fact that we have a surplus now, right, and I think that makes sense what you just said, but I'm also thinking about the fact that we've had some economic growth for almost a decade now, and we may not, and you know, we don't know, housing prices are getting back up to certain levels. From my financial mindset, I always think we're sort of on the cusp of like our market taking a downturn, right? And we're not going to always be in a surplus. And if that's the condition in which allows us to be able to implement a formula like this and to say it's not going to hurt us because we're in a surplus, I am then concerned about the long-term sustainability of something like this and implementing this because I guess what happens then if we become and we can get into a situation in which the state is in a deficit and there is an economic downturn, how does that impact this formula? And then those who now have become reliant on this 2% that is being set aside, and what does that mean for them, and is that sustainable, right? And I don't know these answers, and I would love to maybe just chat with you offline to maybe get more information about that.
And because we have three more bills, we may have to
just a brief response. If there is an economic turndown, every community will suffer the same consequences and will have even probably an exacerbated need for some help from the state. So that doesn't preclude, 95%. I'm sorry, 95 cities and 100 cities next year that would also face the same downturn. So if this is truly one Minnesota, if this is what we're going to work for, then we're in this all together, and we should create some equity in this program. And if there is a downturn, we would all have to share in biting the bullet on that.
And Representative Bernardi has the last question on this.
So I'm going to ask you to be brief in your answers, sure, because we really would like to ask questions rather than have a sales pitch for why it's going on. Because I have concerns that it seems like this setting aside $10, $11 million for the richest cities in Minnesota seems regressive to me. Is that a regressive tax policy, or is that not, would that not be considered regressive? Ms. Dalton, that's the question.
Ms. Dalton.
I have. And if I'm putting you on the spot and it's too much, let me know. But I'm just wondering, is it regressive or progressive in the movement of this change?
I was going to say, Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, that's not actually a question you can really answer because it depends. You know, a city can have a lot of tax wealth and still have a lot of poor people in that city. So regressivity is measured based on personal income, and so it's not clear that I could actually do an analysis to get you an answer on that.
Sorry to put you on that spot, and I should have been talking more about a rich tax base, because when you have a rich tax base, you can afford the services more easily than cities that don't have a rich tax base.
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, I think this actually gets to just the fundamental question of what is the purpose of LGA? And the purpose of LGA has, in recent years, been very focused on meeting unmet needs, allowing cities to provide relatively the same services with relatively the same effort. That's not always been the case, and there are always trade-offs between that. As I said, back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, LGA was really a tax sharing program. Two-thirds of state and local spending happens at the local level. Mm-hmm. Two-thirds of state and local revenue raising happens at the state level. Mm-hmm. So these are all trade-offs that are policy decisions, not necessarily questions that can be answered on a technical basis.
Okay, so thank you for that. And then I just wanted to know, are there any Did you, is this like your formula with Ms. Dalton, or did you have a coalition of communities and cities that helped put this together and came up with a formula? Because the 2013 formula doesn't seem like an antiquated formula to me. So I'm just wondering what groups and organizations and coalition did you work on this formula with?
Representative Hertas.
Thank you. Well, as a past mayor, certainly I've discussed this with the mayor's meetings that I used to attend there. As a legislator, I hear from not only cities, the 11 cities that I represent, but it also hearing from other communities. And as a member of this property tax committee, we've listened to the LGA debate. I've been a part of that for the last 7 years, or this is my seventh year in it. And with regard to trying to figure out how to address the problem, anytime you tinker with the tax policy, usually there's winners and losers. And whether it's the property tax system, when you compress rates or classifications, it causes a shift. And, you know, I just was really trying to figure out a way over the last several years. And when Chair Marquardt was chair of the property tax committee some years ago, I've spoke with him offline on this on a number of issues, and I'm certainly trying to compare some of the problems with these communities. The other thing you have is with local taxes, county taxes, and with school tax levies, it also, when certain homeowners are burdened with a good deal of property tax, it makes it more difficult to pass local levies in schools as well. So this, if LGA really is a property tax aid, this will help address some of that issue.
Okay, so I won't ask any more questions. I'll just say, if I were to have a more conversation, I'd really like to know what the definition of fairness and equity means to you, but I'm not asking you that question, because equity has a totally different meaning to me. So
those are big questions to ask. And members, because this bill, unlike the others, affects a variety, a larger number of cities, while the other bills on today's agenda just affect one, I'm going to ask if there's anyone in the audience who would like to speak on House File 2031. And seeing no one, thank you, Representative Hertas. Would you like to renew your motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I renew my motion, I'd like to thank you for being able to add this bill to the agenda. Because of its lateness and being able to just get the fine details worked out with Ms. Dalton, letters did go out to these 95 cities, and I expect that I'll be receiving replies and responses from most of them. Unfortunately, none of them could be here on short notice and with the meeting scheduled. So thank you for that. And with that, members, I'll renew my motion to consider House File 2031 for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you very much, Representative Hertas. And next we have Representative Poppy. Thank you for your patience. House File 416.
Madam Chair, I move House File 416 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you, Representative Vang. And I believe there is an A1 amendment. Would you like to move that as well?
Yes, so move.
All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Thank you very much, and welcome to the committee, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This has been an issue that the City of Austin has dealt with for the last number of years, probably about 3 years ago. March 31st, 2016, the city received an email stating that the way they had been giving the money to their paid on-call fire relief association, the way they were operating, was no longer the correct way, according to the law, and the state auditor had not been able to let them know that when the law was changed in 2013. So they had a couple of years that they were continuing to do as they had been doing for years and years, but the law had changed. So with me tonight I have Tom Dankert, who's the Director of Administrative Services, our Chief Financial Officer for the city, and he can describe kind of what exactly happened, but what we're seeking is to make the city whole with just over $129,000 that they ended up forfeiting because of this glitch. And so just he'll be able to describe it a little bit more.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dankert. Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Dankert. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the City of Austin. Thank you for your time today. As Representative Poppy had indicated, we've been going through this for a couple of years. The old law that the City of Austin was relying on allowed us to split the state fire aid, which is in essence surcharges set on the local businesses, homes that are transferred to the state and then come back in the form of aid. In the prior years, we were allowed to split that state aid because of a merger of our old relief association into PERA, that allowed us then to take part of the state aid and pay the relief association based on the jointly approved bylaws. Any remaining dollars state aid we use to offset the costs of PERA for our full-timers, so we have a combination fire department. Every year we file our reports with the state auditor's office, get certified that the reports are in compliance, and they release your aid for the or in an October payment. So in 2013-14-15, we got our state fire aid as indicated. We allocated it like we'd always done. As Representative Poppy had indicated, in 2016, we were informed by the state auditor's office that we could no longer split that aid. And oh, by the way, that law was repealed in 2013. At that point in time, they indicated they want us to write a check to the Relief Association, I believe, for around $215,000 for the back state aid. We met with our Relief Association, we met with our City Council members, we met with the State Auditor's Office, we met with our attorneys, and the end result was the City of Austin made the determination that we were going to go after some changes that would allow the City of Austin to keep 13, 14, and 15 aid as we had done and been allowed in the past, and allow us to do the same for 16. End result is, after a couple of years, we did get the relief to allow us to keep the 13, 14, and 15 aid. However, we had to forfeit the 16 aid due to the timing issues of $129,000 because the state or the Office of State Auditors had to certify it by like June 20th in order to get the dollars out. The decision we made was not taken lightly. The Relief Association took a vote themselves. And noted that they didn't deserve this money, this $129,000. They only signed up for the $54,000. So that helped our cause in that they didn't want to get unjustly enriched. Our concern was that if we took the state aid dollars of $129,000 in 16 and paid that $214,000 they said we owed to the Relief Association, many of the members would have seen massive increases in their retirement. Anybody that had retired, we'd had to go back and recalculate payments to them. And then if we went after change to be able to keep the money later, we'd have to go back to them and ask for the money back. The decision made of just forfeiting that state aid and paying the Relief Association out of the city coffers was then, again, the decision we made with the hopes that we could come back and ask the state to get our state fire aid back for that 1 year, 2016, that in essence was forfeited into the state's general fund. So here we are. We believe we've got everything fixed going forward. We have some proposals in front of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirements jointly with other relief associations that we think will fix the problem long term. So we're just asking for a one-time return of the state fire aid insurance premiums that our locals paid into the program.
Great. Thank you. Any questions from members?
Clarification.
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, this is considered the 2% fund, isn't it?
That's correct.
Okay, that's what I want to know.
We have others on the committee who know pension better than I do, that's for sure. I have just one question. If you get the $129,000, then does that go to the other relief fund, or what would be the disposition of that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the City of Austin paid the Relief Association out of other city dollars, and they paid the PERA payment for the full-timers out of city dollars also. So in essence, we've just taken other city dollars, dipped into the fund balance in order to cash flow this with, again, the hopes that this will be paid back into the city coffers.
Thank you. That clarifies it for me. Thank you. And seeing no other questions, any summary remarks, Representative Poppy?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a kind of a complex issue, and we have been dealing with it for 3 years, and we have been before the Pension Commission at least three times, and it's been in the pension bill, and then it got vetoed, and then so what actually the problem that was discovered through the situation with the city of Austin has actually resulted in the pension commission looking differently at the fire relief associations, and it's going to impact forward many cities that have both the paid on call and the permanent full time firefighters. So there's a silver lining, and there's good things that are coming out of it, but it really costs the city, and so we are just seeking this relief to be reimbursed, and we'd really ask that this happen. It's been done last year. It was going to be through state government, and there's just been some issues ongoing. The city has been very patient, trying to hopefully get us at the legislature to work it out for them. So I just really appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, the motion to of Representative Vang to lay over House File 4116 is, as amended, is agreed to.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Marquardt has rushed in from his committee to present House File 1213. It's been a day when we've been trying to juggle people between tense votes. Thank you all. Thank you, and welcome to the committee again.
Very good. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I just had a bill up in public safety, just got done. And I, sorry, Representative Hertaus, I really did want to be here for the discussion. So, yeah, I know you had a very thoughtful bill.
It was a good one. Thank you.
All right. So do I, should I move this?
Or yes,
you should. I will move House File 1213 for a possible inclusion into the division report.
Thank you. And please explain your proposal, Representative Marquardt.
So what this bill would do is appropriate $3 million to the County of Mahnomen. And the County of Mahnomen would have to spend this money on $1 million to the Mahnomen Health Center, which is the first critical access hospital in the state. It serves members of the White Earth Nation and five counties. And this was actually in the 2016 bill that ended up getting vetoed. But the Mahnomen Health Center, about 90% of the folks that come into the emergency room are in poverty. So it's been tough making this hospital work. Another $1 million would go to the White Earth Nation for the transfer of child welfare cases from the county to them, which have added costs. And then the last $1 million would go to the county for health and human services need. And I do have some folks here that can explain more details and some of the reasons more for this bill, if that would be okay, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and please introduce yourself to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bill Haas. I represent the White Earth Tribal Nation. And in 2013, legislation was passed that would transfer the human services functions and ICW functions all to the tribe. This was done, actually, it saved money for the county and the state by doing this. In that process, the tribe incurred approximately $1 million in expenses. They had to run in 40 miles of fiber optic lines so that they could communicate with the MEP system, things like that. So we're asking for reimbursement for those expenses. In addition, the hospital, as Representative Marquardt stated, is a critical access hospital. It's one of the first ones in the state of Minnesota. And they do have a very high percentage of Medicaid and other government programs for health care. So because of that, they have the second highest per capita debt in the state, only behind Hennepin County Medical Center. The other thing is the cash flow. They're losing approximately $500 a day right now in cost. And what this money would be used for would be the stabilization of their cash flow so they can continue to provide services. There's also a nursing home associated with this hospital that would be impacted also. The county reimbursement would be also for their costs incurred with the transfer. But more important right now, what has happened is with the transfer, we've run into a glitch where when White Earth enrolls people in their human services programs, they can do this, all the programs until they come to health care. Once they come to health care and they hit that button, they're kicked out of the system because Minute doesn't recognize them in the system. And the county and the tribe are trying to rectify this, but they've been working on it for a while, and it's kind of a low priority for a minute to work on it. So what has happened is 900 cases have been transferred back to the county. The county hasn't budgeted for these. So now the county's losing money. They actually went from, they had a budget reserve in 2013 of $1.2 million. As of January 1st, it was $128,000. 12 out of the last 27 months, they have been in a deficit position. So it's created quite a burden for them. And the county is quite unique because the county is totally inside of the White Earth Tribal Reservation. So their ability to tax is limited because of the reservation trust land. So it creates even a bigger problem for them. So what House File 1213 asked for is $1 million for reimbursement to White Earth for the cost of implementing these programs. $1 million to the hospital to improve their cash flows so they can continue to provide services for their members. And for the county to help their cash position so they can continue to provide services to the county members. So members, I appreciate your time and your support, and stand for any questions.
Thank you. And do you have another witness? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, this is Mitch Rourke. I'm City Administrator for the City of Manoman. I'm also on the Manoman Health Center Board, and I just wanted to reiterate, the importance of this bill. This is something that was introduced back in 2016. Our hospital is a critical access facility that does serve a huge portion of residents, not just within the reservation, but outside of the reservation. We've been making great strides in our facility's ability to address our debt issues. We went from a $2,500 a day cash deficit to $500 a day cash deficit. We need a little bit more time to continue to work with our federal and our state partners, as well as travel partners, to be able to come to a long-term solution to address this bad debt. As we mentioned, our bad debt is second highest to HCMC. I will give you a report today that the average critical access hospital bad debt is 2% statewide. We're at 400% of that. At one time, we were actually about 140% higher in our bad debt than even HCMC. This funding is critical to ensuring that our hospital can keep its doors open so that we can, again, continue that long-term solution. And so with that, I appreciate hearing from you.
One important note, this is a one-time funding. I forgot to mention that as I introduced the bill. One-time funding.
And we do have a question from someone else, but while we're still just on understanding the funding, I believe it's Representative Purcell that has some ongoing money for some of the tribes for child welfare costs. Is this related to that proposal? I believe that White Earth Band was one of his proposals.
Madam Chair, that is to pay for the ongoing administrative cost for providing the Indian child welfare. White Earth has been running a deficit in that program because of we've been so successful in out-of-home placements and foster care and working with the children, the tribal children, to get them placed in good homes. So that is a totally separate issue in this. This is the cost of transferring those programs, what White Earth had to go through with running the fiber optic lines, getting everything up to speed, the training, the facilities, the whole works, because they have four different facilities within the reservation so they can better serve their people. And so that is where this one-time cost. This was actually, DHS was going to reimburse us for all these costs. And in 2016, DHS did not have the money, and Senator Scoy was the one who came up with the idea that we could just do a one-time payment out of the tax bill to the tribe and the and then to shore up the financials for the hospital and then help the county out.
Thank you. And Representative Hewitt has a question.
Mike's. Thank you, Madam Chair. You're right, that hospital is one of the best hospitals. Well, it's needed in the area. I've worked with this hospital before in my past, and I find some interesting facts that I found out just working in the legislature here. Many of the tribes are almost 80% not insured by health coverage, and that's part of this problem, is that they don't either seek it or they don't get into the system. And when these people come into these ERs or come into these hospitals, usually they're pretty sick, and the hospitals have to absorb this cost. It's not coming back to the state. The hospitals just have to eat it. And so this isn't a much-needed grant, members. And I encourage the tribes to try to figure out how we can get them in the system, because once they're in the system and Medicaid does kick in, we can actually get them into a care plan, right, because that's what we're looking at. So I was devastated to hear this number. This is the highest amount of uninsured people we have in the in the state. And somehow we got to work on the system, because it's definitely affecting our economy. And here's a situation that, you know, pay me now or pay me later. So that hospital is needed in that area. You guys have saved multiple lives in that area, and we have to make sure it's still there. But what can we do about the problem so we don't see this again?
Mr. Haas.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hewitt, with the health care, there's another catch-22. If a tribal member goes into the hospital and does not have insurance, there's a catch-22 in the system with DHS that they just can't auto-enroll in the system at that point. So that has created a problem, and I know White Earth and the county and the hospital have been working on this, and DHS, to try to get this rectified so that we can get those people qualified when they go in, so the bills are paid. The other problem is high deductible health plans. When they go in, they got a $6,000 or $13,000 deductible, and when the counties, you know, when you look at the poverty levels in the county and within the tribal nation, they're very high. And how do you get somebody who's making $15,000, $20,000 a year to pay a $13,000 deductible? It's just really tough. And so that's why we're working with all those entities to try to do this and to make it work. But it just takes time. We've changed a lot of law to make all this happen. We got a little bit to go.
Madam Chair, thank you. And yes, it's a hole, and you guys are in it. So
yep.
Whatever. I support it. You guys need it.
Okay. Representative Marquardt, any concluding remarks?
No, just thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thanks for the testifiers providing the detailed information on this. Thank you much.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Marquardt renews his motion that House File 1213 be laid over for consideration in the division report. And thank you, Representative Kreisha. House File 904, you've been very patient. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 904 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you, Chair Bang, for moving House File 904. Welcome to the committee. Representative Kreisha, please tell us about this proposal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I have with me the mayor of Flensburg. What happened here is just human error, just the filing, missed some filing deadlines, as happens when people are trying to do lots of things in small towns. And as in the past with other situations like this, you can go back and with approval we can pay those and forgo the penalties. So with that, we have a bill here to help Flensburg out, and I'll let the mayor of Flensburg talk about it briefly, and I'll turn over.
Welcome to the committee, Mayor Flensburg.
Thank you.
Mayor Gessel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you, Ron. I'm John Gessel, Jr., Mayor of Flensburg. Thank you for having this hearing for the City of Flensburg for LGA recovery. We have a population of 250 people, and we have 13 farms in our city limits, and my farm is one of them. I called Representative Ron Kreisha for assistance. Representative Kreisha, Minnesota League of Minnesota Cities and Minnesota State Auditor's Office, assisted the city with it's needed audit extensions and legislative work for the audit to get completed. When the city was reaching out for assistance from Representative Kreisha and the League of Minnesota Cities, the City of Flensburg continued to contact firms to complete the audit. All declined. In December 2017, the City Council members came to the CAPTA, met with Representative Kreisha and Gary Carlson of League of Minnesota Cities. A bill for city penalty forgiveness was drawn up and approved. This provided an extension for the city to complete the 2016 audit to June 2018. The city reached out to the state auditor, who agreed to work with the city and requested another extension on the audit deadline. The state auditor went on to complete the audit, finalizing it in October of 2018. The cost to the city for the state audit was $39,510.26. This was paid in full. We are looking for the other $15,124. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, members? We've seen these before. We understand sometimes there are circumstances. Seeing no questions, any concluding remarks, Representative Kreisha?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just leave it at this. We all have worked with many small towns, and I know people like Mayor Gessel and others, I mean, this is a huge stress on them. And they're trying to do everything in their else. They're trying to do all the things they're doing, plus keep the city running, and something like this will not only take care of the fiscal, but also will probably allow you to sleep better at night.
Thank you for that. And with that, Representative Vang renews her motion that House File 904 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. And members, I must say thank you very much for your patience with our late start when we ran into technical difficulties, and for moving quickly through a long, long agenda. We're going to have a few more of those, and I really appreciate your patience and dedication to coming here when you're not required to be with bills and other. And as always, we will try, and when we're asked to respond to the schedule limitations of your witnesses, particularly if they're from out of town. And with that, members, have a good evening. The division is adjourned.